Qualified immunity is a legal doctrine designed to give public servants, like town officials and police officers, protection from personal liability for violating someone else's civil rights while performing official duties unless the official violated a clearly established constitutional right. On the one hand, defenders of the doctrine say it's necessary to protect government officials and police officers who could face severe financial hardship for decisions that have to be made quickly under stressful conditions. According to the National Council of State Legislatures, the Supreme Court has offered multiple justifications for qualified immunity, including that it encourages government officials to, quote, unflinchingly discharge their duties, unquote, without worrying about being sued for actions a court has not yet held to violate the Constitution. On the other hand, opponents argue it's a way to avoid accountability for wrongful actions and makes bringing lawsuits in response to those wrongful actions more difficult than they should be. The Vermont legislature is considering a bill which would eliminate qualified immunity as far as it applies to police forces. State Senator Dick Sears, who chairs the state's Senate Judiciary Committee, is backing the bill with three co-sponsors, Senators Becca Ballant, Philip Baruth, and Kesharam Hinsdale. James Baker, who until recently was serving as the commissioner of the state's Department of Corrections, capping off a long and distinguished career in law enforcement which saw him serve as the commander of the Vermont State Police, as well as tours as the chief of police both in Rutland and Manchester, has concerns about eliminating the protection, and certainly as it applies to police officers and those in law enforcement. We had a chance to talk with both of them recently to hear their views.
Unlike other laws, this has been not passed by any legislature. This was a thing that the Supreme Court did back in the 60s. And in the 80s, it started to take a turn where the Supreme Court, United States Supreme Court, and the Vermont Supreme Court has done the same, where the facts had to be basically the same. Had to be a previous case with virtual identical facts. And on that basis alone, somebody could be denied their constitutional rights, denied that their rights were violated and their suit is dismissed. So some of the more egregious ones obviously happened in other states. There's no question about that. In Vermont, there's been several cases. The one I will talk about is Keene versus Snyder. And the troopers were permitted to enter Mr. Keene's home. They questioned him in his living room about a possible DUI. The troopers decided to arrest him on suspicion of DUI, which was later dismissed by the state's attorney, by the way. And he refused to go with them. The troopers pepper sprayed him, took him to the floor, repeatedly punched, elbowed, and kneed him in front of his crying 14-year-old daughter. The district court in Vermont denied qualified immunity for the trooper, but it went to the Second Circuit of the United States courts, and they reversed the ruling, granting qualified immunity because the trooper's action did not violate clearly established law without deciding whether the force was excessive. There's been other cases in Vermont of a similar nature. And so there has been a nationwide effort to change qualified immunity, either, you know, through legislation. And the bill that I introduced along with Senators Baruth, Ram, Hinsdale, and Ballant is modeled on the Colorado law. Now, there have been over 35 states introduced bills on qualified immunity, and only two states have actually passed them due to heavy lobbying efforts and by law enforcement particularly, but other groups like the Vermont League of Cities and Towns, which have fought this and are fighting it here in Vermont. So when we introduced the bill based on Colorado, it had several provisions. I'm not suggesting that we have any disrespect for troopers or police, local police. I have the greatest respect for them and the tough job that they do. But this just seems something that the legislature should at least openly discuss. And that's what we're doing. And I said right from the beginning that if there are other alternatives, if there are ways to make this law that's been developed through case law and not legislation improve so that when there are egregious cases like the two that I described, people can have their day in court and not have their civil rights or constitutional rights violated. And we've had two hearings on it in Senate Judiciary, and we're going to continue to listen to both sides. And in this case, there's probably four or five sides to it. One of the concerns is, and I understand that, like everything else these days, is recruitment is very difficult. Whether it be troopers or grocery store clerks or nurses, or you name the profession, we're having a hard time filling those positions. So I understand that. And if we need to, we are trying to address that in the Senate Appropriations Committee, by the way. But, you know, we're going to continue to hold hearings. We're going to continue to look at the issue. I don't know where the bill will go. I really don't. This is not one of those where I feel like, wow, we're going to make it and we're going to do this. So, you know, that's pretty much what it is and where we're at right now.
We then paid a virtual visit with Colonel James Baker to hear his take on the issue.
Qualified immunity is a legal defense. It doesn't prevent anyone from filing a lawsuit. If they have been grieved by the government. Now, what the bill proposes is taking qualified immunity out of everyone who has the right to the defense of qualified immunity, which I'll tell you what the clearly established law means in a minute. Out of everyone that's entitled to qualified immunity, from select board members to highway department drivers to state health department officials to town managers, town administrators, out of everyone who's covered by qualified immunity, the people they want to remove that legal defense from are police officers, who probably face some of the most challenging situations that are fraught with opportunities to have bad outcomes. And so, what the concept of qualified immunity is, it's a legal defense that is set by not only the U.S. Supreme Court, but the Vermont Supreme Court has ruled on it as well. And the current test for clearly established law, the facts of the case alleged by the plaintiff who's suing shows that the government official's conduct violated a constitutional right. That's part of the standard. The second part of that, which is the important part, that at the time of the allegation of the violation, that the violation violated a clearly established law or decision at the time, a court standard at the time of the alleged conduct. What the legislation would do now is remove the clearly established standard. So think about that for a minute. You would, as a police officer, you would be making decisions wondering what the court may rule on in the future to establish a standard. It puts police officers in an almost impossible position. And it doesn't, as some people would say, even the senator's letter to the paper, would leave people with the impression that it shuts you out of the ability to file a lawsuit. That's just not factually true. Unfortunately, in my career, I've been involved in lawsuits where I've been named in lawsuits where unjustifiably I've been named in lawsuits. And I think people may not understand this, because they think qualified immunity prevents people from having access to filing a lawsuit. It's just not factually true. So, and all you have to do is look at the latest lawsuit that's been filed in Bennington County against the state police for $25 million. That lawsuit has been filed. The judge will decide if qualified immunity, and a motion will be made by the attorneys representing the state to invoke qualified immunity to remove the officers personally from the lawsuit. That's what qualified immunity does.
So if someone feels they've been unnecessarily physically roughed up by a police officer in an encounter, what's their recourse then? I mean, do they have some way of saying, hey, I really felt like the police officer was over the top in this situation? They do have a way to get some recompense for that.
What is the recourse? There's a recourse through the agencies. There's a recourse through the Criminal Justice Council certification and decertification, and you can still file a lawsuit if you believe that you were grieved. Mm-hmm. Qualified immunity is only part of the process to provide a defense for police officers being personally held responsible for the action. And again, I think everyone would agree, you shouldn't be trying to hold someone accountable for their actions on a standard that isn't set yet. That's why law enforcement is so opposed to the conversation about changing qualified immunity. What the law would do now is a judge would rule later a new standard and hold the officer to that new standard post the bad act. And I think, you know, again, that's why I think law enforcement and why I think going down that route is feels really punitive towards law enforcement officers personally.
According to a recent news report in VT Digger, recent polling shows nearly 3 in 4 Vermonters support eliminating qualified immunity in the state. And that support extends across the political and geographical spectrum. Currently, the bill, known as S-254, is under consideration in the Senate Judiciary Committee. For the GNet TV News Project, I'm Andrew McKeever. At town meeting this year, voters in Manchester will have a chance to weigh in on several articles beyond the basic ones, such as the proposed town budgets and the resulting tax rates, along with organizations that typically seek town support for their work and activities, such as the Community Library, the Tutorial Center, Habitat for Humanity, and Neighbor to Neighbor, to name a few. Added to this group this year will be the Northshire Day School, which is hoping to get a thumbs up on a request for $87,000. The school is also seeking support in smaller amounts from the towns of Dorset and Sunderland. But each year also brings new items to the warning, and this year is no exception. One would authorize the town to spend up to $120,000 to purchase the rail trail, constructed in recent years by a local group which has been hoping to sell it to the town for a while. The trail, which follows an old railroad line, is currently privately owned and has been the topic of previous studies and town meeting discussions. Another is an advisory vote on a proposed field house, which will be constructed at the Manchester Recreational Park if this and other advisory votes in other towns provide forward momentum for the concept. Other articles include ones involving sewers and wastewater. One would create a new sewer district that would run along Route 7A from the library to the town's North Road, and another would authorize the town officials to spend up to $1.9 million to construct the sewer lines and system infrastructure in the new wastewater district. To discuss these and other articles on the warning, we recently sat down with Town Manager John O'Keefe. We started with the article on the field house.
And so this will give us a really good indication of what communities, of course, you know, if it passes in Manchester, what communities are interested in partnering with Manchester on the final project. But it's advisory only. There's no binding action being taken. But it should give us a pretty good sense of public support for the project.
And then there's the rail trail is also back. This is one that's been discussed before.
Yep.
What is going to be happening with the rail trail this year?
So this year, there's an article that authorizes the select board to spend up to $125,000 from the CERC fund the Capital Reserve Fund to purchase the rail trail, and then another $50,000 to do some preliminary improvements. I don't expect the $50,000 will be the total amount that will be necessary to improve it over time, but it'll do the sort of things that we think are important short term. That'll be contingent upon us getting two different easements, one from Daly Gravel Pit and one from Riley Rink. So we won't buy it without those.
So then the question, I guess, for voters to consider is that it'll be up to the town to maintain it going forward into the future.
It will be. And we've done some estimates. We're not planning to plow it in the wintertime because it's gravel. It'll be limbing, mowing, washouts and things like that. I can't remember the exact estimate, but I think it's less than $5,000 a year annually that the DPW director thinks it'll take to maintain it.
And then I guess the other big is, I think, more than one article on the proposed sewer district or an expansion, mm-hmm. or I guess a creation of an entirely new sewer district.
But right now we're looking at least Cemetery Ave on Main Street up to the mobile home park. We feel that it's really important to get the mobile home park on public water and sewer. So to create a new district that would allow us to do separate financing, and then the bond required to do that work, that would be offset by connection fees. The one reason that we're pushing ahead with this is that there may be significant state funds that would be available for the project.
Is this the ARPA money? Would that be going towards that?
Some of the town's ARPA money could go towards it, but this is actually other federal monies that have been put into infrastructure that would go through the state. The ARPA money came directly to the town. Up through this stretch, I mean, there is a lot of available property. It's been an area that's been designated by the Planning Commission as an area of growth. And if we're going to tackle the affordable housing issue, it's really important that you provide public utilities for that, because otherwise you're buying a lot more land in order to build a single family house or an apartment complex, because you're always offsetting that usage with a septic system.
So then we have the cannabis question as well, mm-hmm. whether or not the town's voters will authorize the town to be able to be a town where cannabis could be sold. So is the question simply an up and down one as to whether or not the town wants to mm-hmm. allow for retailers to open shop?
So the last time the legislature talked about this, you actually had to opt out. In this case, communities are being asked if they want to opt into it. And it's only for retail. There's a whole bunch of different licenses that can be granted by the state involving testing, cultivation, manufacturing, and retail. So the only question that is before the voters of Manchester is about retail sales, whether they want to authorize a retail sale of marijuana and cannabis in Manchester. And then there's a description in the town report that kind of talks about what can and cannot be done. There is some ability for the local municipality to regulate cannabis sales like it would any other business through public nuisance and through zoning. But the state law is pretty specific that you can't regulate cannabis any more than you regulate other businesses.
Because the town had an ordinance in place before, right?
We still do.
And so does the state law kind of overrule that? Is that basically what the situation is?
I think the process is if town meeting votes to allow retail cannabis, then the select board would consider removing that particular stipulation. It's in the town chapter entitled Commerce. And it does a couple things. It prohibits the sale of marijuana in Manchester. It limits gun sales within 1,000 feet of schools. I think there's something in there about uranium as well.
Could such stores have events where products were sampled? And then the idea being, well, then people leave, and are they then able to go out and drive? Or
There's no consumption that's authorized under state law right now. There is some thought among advocates that you would have consumption lounges. I guess you'd call it, the equivalent of a bar. But right now, there is no on-site. The only place that you can legally consume cannabis is in your own house.
Manchester will hold a virtual information meeting on Saturday, February 26th, beginning at 1 p.m., Login information to the meeting is available on the town's website at manchester-vt.gov. All the articles will be decided by Australian balloting voting, as will elections for town officials. Polls will open at 8 a.m. at the town hall and remain open until 7 p.m. Early voting is also an option for those who prefer that. For the GNet TV News Project, I'm Andrew McKeever. Voters in Arlington will be asked to pass muster on both a school district budget and one for the town when they head for the polls on Tuesday, March 1st, for town meeting day. But before then, they will also get to vote on the proposed town budget of slightly under $1.83 million, which compares to one of about $1.7 million last year. This will be discussed and voted upon during an informational meeting held Monday, February 28th, at the Arlington Memorial High School gym. The remaining 40 articles in the town warning, most of them familiar ones, which call for various sums to be spent on reserve funds for the town's highway department, or fire department, rescue squad, or other initiatives, like sidewalk maintenance or removal of diseased and hazardous trees, will be decided by Australian ballot during voting on March 1st. The voting will also take place at the high school gym from 10 a.m. to 7 p.m. Town Administrator Nick Zayas walked us through the highlights of the proposed town budget.
We expect a net change in property taxes of about 7%, and that represents about $100,000 increase from the previous year in taxes, and which is roughly in line with the rate of inflation. One matter that the board expressed very clearly was protecting the town's purchasing power right now in a time where we don't want to have to delay investments in the community because of inflation alone. So the benchmark that we had was keeping the tax rate in line with inflation. I will note that for the most part, this was a very run-of-the-mill budget. And the warning likewise reflects that. That said, there are three articles that were petitioned by voters and will be addressed in the vote by Australian ballot at town meeting, and those are the three articles relate to the town's carbon emissions, one of which is about setting a goal, one of which is setting up a sinking fund, and one of which is funding the sinking fund with a $50,000 contribution from the taxpayers. Those articles were petitioned by the voters, and we certainly look forward to seeing the will of the voters being expressed through the votes on those three articles. There are no proposals to change the structure of government, and Arlington voters of the last couple of years have experienced a number of articles about that, creating my own position, making adjustments to the auditor office last year, and which successfully passed, and another article that did not successfully pass on those matters. The board has expressed a happiness with the structure of the government as it currently sees it being, and until our situation changes with regard to volunteerism or availability of staff, we certainly do not expect to be offering structure of government articles. At least, certainly not this year. We hope not in future years until a matter presents itself as necessary.
Voters will also decide two contested races for the 5-person Arlington Select Board. Matthew Bukowski is stepping down after a single 3-year term, and James Postian and Vincent Thompson have filed papers for election to the seat. Incumbent Select Board member Cynthia Browning is also seeking another term, and she's being opposed by newcomer Joe Jervis. Meanwhile, over on the school district side, voters will also hear from the school board about a proposed budget of more than $7.1 million, which, if adopted, would raise spending by slightly under 4%, but would also lower property tax rates. The school budget will also be decided by Australian ballot voting on March 1st. The Arlington and Sandgate school districts, along with their supervisory union, the Battenkill Valley Supervisory Union, were merged last year into the Southwest Vermont Supervisory Union. We asked William Basic, the former superintendent of the now-dissolved BVSU, who's now serving as an assistant superintendent in the SVSU, to help facilitate the merger of Arlington and Sandgate into the Southwest Vermont Supervisory Union, to give us an overview of what's in the proposed Arlington school budget.
I think, you know, we've done a really good job over the last 5 or 6 years of really coming in with some steady numbers. You know, we're in a very lucky position. We kind of know what we need in Arlington. You know, we have really good programming that we've already funded. So now it's just kind of going year to year, making sure we can do that. This will be the fourth year in a row of a tax decrease to the town, which is nice. I mean, certainly not a massive tax decrease, but anytime you get a property tax decrease, that's something that the taxpayers can certainly be happy about, especially when we know that it's going into a quality school. So it's not that we're cutting programs to achieve those tax decreases. We've also built up a pretty healthy surplus over the last 4 or 5 years. So this year they'll see when they do go to the town vote on March 1st that there's going to be a series of sinking funds that we'd like to replenish, if you will. We're going to be looking to put over about $200,000 into various funds that certainly are listed, you know, things like transportation, school building maintenance, technology, and the rest of those are there. And that's a good way to give yourself financial security down the road in case something goes poorly with your HVAC or your bus breaks down, you're covered, so you don't have to go right back to the taxpayers. So from that, we're looking very good. The only thing that was a little controversial this year that we certainly received feedback from was that we did join with the SVSU. The BVSU is now gone. So there will be some assessments coming from them, and they did turn out to be higher than in years past, which was a little disappointing because we were hoping that when we joined the SVSU that we would receive some financial benefit to it. That does not appear that will happen. They're not huge. There's certainly stuff that won't bankrupt, but it's, we're still kind of putting final numbers on them, but they're probably somewhere between 200 and 350,000, kind of going back and forth, and the positions we've eliminated here and just trying to figure that out. And, you know, I would say that a pretty fair number is around $200,000 extra that it actually costs to join the SVSU. So that was disappointing. We do not foresee savings in the future. I think that that part of the merger did not work out. What we are hopefully looking forward to, the Act 46 did have two goals. One was to create financial efficiencies. That is not going to occur. And the second was to create more learning opportunities for students. So that one is still remains to be seen. So we haven't really gotten into the curriculum side or a sharing of programming with the SVSU. So, you know, hopefully we will find some increased opportunities for students. So we can say the merger was a success.
The annual school district meeting will start at 6:30 p.m. on February 28th in the Arlington Memorial High School gym. The meeting will be largely informational. Two school board positions will also be decided on March 1st during Australian ballot voting. Newcomer Luke Hall is hoping to unseat incumbent school board member Nicole Whalen for a 3-year position, and Jessica Elwell Bacciocci is hoping to replace current school board member Robert Zink, who opted not to run for re-election to the 2-year position. For the GNET TV News Project, I'm Andrew McKeever. Among the 45 articles Arlington voters will be asked to decide on during this year's coming town meeting season are 3 that deal directly with climate change. Or maybe make that climate mitigation. Voters will be asked to approve the creation of a climate mitigation fund and then to place $50,000 in it to help finance the reduction of carbon dioxide emissions from fossil fuels. And finally, to determine if voters are in favor of reducing those emissions through energy efficiencies, carbon sequestration, and adoption of renewable energy. One of the forces behind getting these 3 articles on the town's warning is Marty Crane-Gaudreau, a retired professor from Dartmouth College. She told us about the inspiration of these articles during a conversation with a granddaughter several years ago.
There was an event where one of my grandchildren and I were out walking some years ago, and I asked, "What do you plan to do when you grow up?" And the answer was, "It won't matter unless we do something about climate change." And taking the steam out of your sails, you know, the wind out of your sails. It was like, wow, here is the voice of youth speaking to my generation.
Professor Crane went on to describe what these articles would accomplish if they passed muster. A combination of tax savings and avoiding the worser case climate scenarios are the rewards that await, she says.
Another issue was the cost of taxes, to be honest with you. Looking at the amounts of money, when I really started looking at this issue, I looked at the town reports and looked at the amounts of money that we were spending on fuel oil, heating oil, for town hall, we in Arlington also pay for the heating the fire departments, the town garage. And essentially, there was a lot of money that was being spent on those issues. And there's a fair amount of electricity. Town hall in the summertime, besides electricity for lighting, we use the old-fashioned kinds of air conditioners, you know, that you set in a window, which are not particularly efficient. So Arlington taxpayers have been paying for this. And, you know, it's the way it's been. It's just the way it's been. But when you're sitting on an energy committee and you do assessments of this sort of thing, you realize that we're spending money on that we don't need to be spending. I thought, you know, essentially, if we just sit on our hands and do nothing, it's going to take several years for the select board to feel comfortable going out and putting money in the budget for all of these different things. So why not be bold?
The articles come against the background of the work of Vermont's Climate Council, which last December published a report outlining more than 200 steps the state could take to reduce its carbon emissions output and help make a contribution to lowering the warming of the planet. The state legislature is now working to turn these recommendations into legislation. And climate concerns have, of course, been much in the news in recent years as more evidence accumulates about the impact of a warmer planet on weather patterns. More recently, Arlington was one of the sites in Bennington County where the Window Dressers Project, which built to order sets of insulating window inserts to reduce heating costs for area residents, was held. It all goes to show that even if Vermont is only one small state, every contribution matters, Marty Crane said.
You know, a lot of people are overwhelmed by the concept of climate change. They'll say, well, what can I do about it? Well, this is something that everybody, every voter in Arlington can take a little bit of pride and so on in being able to do something about climate change and allow themselves to think about it and think about other things that they might be able to do. So I see this as a, as I said, it's a win-win situation for Arlington and the people who live here.
Voters in Arlington will get to discuss these articles during their informational meeting planned for Monday, February 28th, which starts at 6:30 p.m. at the Arlington Memorial High School gym. Voting on articles to be decided by Australian ballot will be held on Tuesday, March 1st, starting at 10 a.m., also at the high school gym. For the GNET TV News Project, I'm Andrew McKeever. Voters in Dorset will be asked to approve a proposed town budget of about $2.7 million when they go to the polls on March 1st, town meeting day. Early voting is also an option. Those who wish to do so should check in with the town clerk's office. Voting will take place at the town office on Mad Tom Road in East Dorset. Town officials will also be holding an informational meeting electronically on the articles contained in the warning. That will take place on Monday, February 28th, starting at 7 p.m. To learn more about what's in the budget and warned articles, we talked with Dorset's town manager, Rob Giotti.
In Dorset, is similar to some other towns, you know, in and around our area, we've made the decision to hold an all virtual informational meeting as this basically the same as what was done last year. Normally, we utilize the Dorset School and a hybrid style meeting, I think, was was something that was the technology and the prospects, I think, make that difficult. It tends to be hard for the for both groups to interact, the people in the room versus the people that are on Zoom to kind of hear or interact. So we voted to go all virtual, which means that all the voted articles will be Australian ballot like they were last year. So we typically have, you know, anywhere from, you know, 18 to 20, you know, 25 articles or so, that show up on the warning. Most, the bulk of which, you know, there are the setting of tax collection dates and delinquency dates. The, in general, the town budget from fiscal 22 to 23 is projected to go up around 3.2% in total. You know, the couple of items that are baked into that budget are things like, you know, last year we'd approved a bond for a new town office. We've got some funding in this year's budget to essentially start to plan for future bond payments. We're still in the permitting process for the project, so we're, you know, we're probably looking at a groundbreaking sometime in the spring of 23. We most likely will have one or two budget cycles to save a little money up and stash it away so that when we get to the repayment of that bond, that the full amount of that won't be showing up in our, you know, in our budget all in one fell swoop, which would have a, you know, a negative impact on kind of pushing rates up. So there's $75,000 in our budget to kind of start that. That's about 60% or a little more of what the actual bond payment eventually will be, depending on the, you know, the final kind of scope of the project. Another piece is that we're, you know, for better for worse, unfortunately for us, but fortunately for Sandy, she's our town clerk, and she's talking about, you know, transitioning to part-time and then retiring. And so we've included, kind of a transition package, in this budget, to allow for the hiring of a full-time assistant clerk that can be trained, you know, for probably 12 to 18 months. You know, one of the unique things about clerks is that they run elections, and those don't happen all the time. They happen, you know, once a year. Or, you know, the large general elections happen every few years. So our hope is to get through an election cycle or two, both local and then, you know, state, and then have that transition go through. And, you know, we're really fortunate to have Sandy here, and we are going to be, you know, sad to see her leave, and we're hoping we can make the transition last a little while, so she'll be around for a while. Those are kind of the two big things that's in our budget. You know, as far as tax rates, you know, our grand list, you know, is we're expecting it to go up, you know, anywhere from, you know, 3 to we try to be conservative, but 3% to, you know, maybe as high, as much as 8 or 9%. So ultimately we see that, you know, that 3.2%, increase on the budget from year to year probably is going to correlate to, or probably around a 4%, tax increase, which would get us in the realm of somewhere around 33 or 34 cents per hundred. Which is, you know, maybe about a penny per hundred more from last year.
One article on Dorset's warning is for the proposed Fieldhouse in Manchester. It's an advisory vote, and Dorset's contribution is estimated at $1.3 million via a 30-year bond.
The functionality is planned to be a bond. So, you know, $1.3 million over 30 years is around $60,000 a year. So that's the number, I guess, that we'd be asked to put in. I think, the approach that the select board took, with this article was that, you know, we didn't get a lot of feedback, at our meetings when it was presented. You know, I think at the meeting, at the Dorset School, which was one of the early informational meetings, There might have been a couple dozen people there. So not a lot of feedback, positive, negative, otherwise. So it's kind of hard to gauge where people are. So which I think helps with the, you know, having the advisory vote gives you a better sense of people's thoughts of it. So our article is more or less the actual voted article that was provided by the proponents was put into our warning, and we've added a little bit of information at the bottom of that, just kind of on the pretense of, you know, people are busy and not everybody has the time to either sit through a select board meeting or to have gone to one of the informational meetings. You know, maybe they've read a little bit about it, but they don't know kind of specifically what it, you know, what it means, you know, for them as a, you know, in this case, as a taxpayer and voter and endorse it. So we've got a kind of a paragraph of language in there that basically, you know, explains that it's a $1.3 million bond for 30 years. You know, that the current plan is for the building to be owned and operated by Manchester. And that our plan is if the advisory article passes, the select board will then, you know, has the ability to participate in the negotiation of a, you know, an interlocal agreement between all the towns to give representation on an advisory board for the field house. And then kind of, pending that agreement being in place, then a follow-up bond vote would then occur.
Other articles on Dorset's warning include a request for $15,000 to the Dorset Marble Preservation Association for the purpose of restoring Dorset's marble sidewalks, a request for $20,000 to the Dorset Players to help sustain the Dorset Playhouse Preservation and Maintenance Fund for ongoing repairs to the playhouse, and whether or not voters wish to appropriate the sum of $13,000 to the North Shore Day School to help them defray the cost of early childhood education services in the region. Again, Dorset's informational meeting will start at 7 p.m. on Monday, February 28th, with Australian ballot voting held on Tuesday, March 1st, at the Town Hall. For the GNet TV News Project, I'm Andrew McKeever.